Let's just pray as we start. Father, we pray that as we look at this well-known chapter of Daniel, that you will teach us new things that are relevant for our lives today. For we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. So I guess that Daniel 6 must be one of the best known stories in the entire Bible, perhaps competing with something like David and Goliath. Perhaps one day we'll have a little poll around and see. And I certainly remember hearing about this story more than 50 years ago in Sunday school. The thing is that if you look at this chapter in isolation, you can miss one or two things. The most important thing is probably the time over which events in Daniel 1 to 6 actually take place. And when he's first taken to Babylon, Daniel is just in his teens. So I'm just going to briefly review what happens previously there as well. So Daniel and his three friends arrive in Babylon, and Daniel is a teenager. And then in chapter 2, we have Daniel faced in the position where he needs, basically at the cost of his own life, to reveal what Nebuchadnezzar had as a dream and to tell him the interpretation. Not just one or the other, but both. In Daniel chapter 3, Daniel's three friends, who he joins with in prayer in chapter 2, are cast into a fiery furnace because they won't bow down to a very large golden statue. But they survive the fiery furnace. In chapter 4, there's another dream that Nebuchadnezzar has, and Daniel has to interpret that and has to give Nebuchadnezzar a warning about his own behavior that comes from God. And he does that. Then in chapter 5, which we saw looked at 3 weeks ago, there's the writing on the wall that appears as a subsequent king, Belshazzar, is celebrating unwisely, and God's finger writes on the wall. And they don't understand what it means, and Daniel explains what that writing means. And soon after that, Babylon falls to the Medes and the Persians. And so the golden head of the dream that Nebuchadnezzar has in chapter 2 gives way to the silver chest and the arms representing the Medes and the Persians. And one of the interesting things about this chapter is how law has changed. And of course, laws do change over time. We've seen it in my own lifetime, certain laws having changed, by some for good and some not for good. But actually, if you go back in time, it's into the distant past, as it were. In 1792 to 1750, Hammurabi, who was in charge of Babylon at that time, actually had these principles. Cause justice to prevail in the country. Sounds good. Destroy the wicked and the evil. That sounds pretty good. The strong may not oppress the weak. Surely great. There's a stone containing 282 laws in the Louvre in Paris there. But, of course, Nebuchadnezzar actually acted above the law during his reign. He was the boss. When he went into a temper, everybody had better watch out. The difference here in the laws of the Medes and the Persians is that once they're enacted, they cannot be taken away. So Darius could not do the same thing here. And actually, there's an interesting thing that laws are there to put values into place. And they're not always easily replaced. I don't know whether you are aware of it, but it's been mentioned briefly in the news because of Donald Trump and his administration, but there was a landmark case called Roe versus Wade, which was about abortion rights in the United States. And the name Roe is actually an alias for the woman who brought the case and actually prevailed on that. 20 years later, she became a Christian. She thought she had done entirely the wrong thing on those previous things. Could she get the law changed? Well, no, of course she couldn't. And Deuteronomy 7, verses 18 to 20, says what God thinks about law. God thinks that everybody is subject to law, even the king. But no human system, of course, is perfect. And now to chapter 6. But actually, briefly, before I go on that, I'm going to tell you a little story about law. I don't know who's heard of a Russian Jew called Isaac Asimov, who emigrated to the United States. And he was initially a professor of biochemistry, and then he later went on to write science fiction full time. And because, again, it's contemporary, we've had the rise of AI, haven't we? And Asimov, one of his most famous things that he did was to come up with three laws of robotics. So you had, if you've got a robot there, you want it under control in some ways. So the first law of robotics was that a robot shouldn't allow a human being to come to harm. The second law of robotics was that a robot must obey the orders of human beings except where they conflict with law one. And the third law was it must protect its own existence as long as it didn't conflict with laws two and one. Although there were some nuances there, and Asimov had a great fun with it all, because obviously you don't really want people going around ordering robots to destroy themselves, because they're valuable commodities. So, but he had great fun with that. But the interesting point and the relevant point that I hope you'll see, at least to some extent, and it's not just me having fun, is that there was a humanoid robot called Daniel, although it was spelt differently by Asimov. It's spelt with two E's in the middle. And at one point in one of his later stories, this human robot developed a new ability. That was the ability to read human minds and to actually influence them as well. And Daniel, of course, was built with these three laws of robotics in place. And he effectively overrode the three laws of robotics with what he called the zeroth law of robotics, that he must protect humanity. And that overrode the protection of an individual human being. Now, I will point it out later, but I want you to try and think of how there is an analogy here between the way that the human Daniel operated and the way that the robot, humanoid robot Daniel, operated. But anyway, let's return to Babylon. So Daniel's there, and actually what I want to say is that in many ways the culture and the times were not as different as we might think from our own day. Now you might think that, you know, what does he do in his time in the 21st century? Well, yeah, okay, we've developed technologically very much. We have a different system of government. Yeah, you can call it democratic. You could call it an elected dictatorship, the way that first past the post actually works, but there you go. But in more essential ways, our society is very similar to that of Daniel's, more so ever than just 50 years ago. It's dominated by secular concerns, by material prosperity. We have the idea of tolerant liberalism having a dominant position today. What I mean by that is that we're called not just to respect other religions and other beliefs, but also not to criticize the things that we think are wrong with them. So society is tolerating both the amoral and the immoral. And those things were true of Babylonian society as well. In general, Daniel was free to actually practice his Jewish faith. But at various times there were challenges, particularly to his three friends, about bowing down to this golden statue. And in chapter one, there was a challenge on food laws. And for all sorts of reasons, our society does restrict what we can do. And increasingly on those sorts of conditions as to what we're supposed to do and how we can express our faith, there is a little bit of a challenge coming up. On a more mundane level, most of us actually have to work in secular employment. We have to face all the issues and challenges that come with that, and they do come. But in the midst of a Babylonian society that definitely wasn't his first choice, Daniel was faithful to God throughout his time there. We don't have any in-depth details of exactly what he was doing, but we can see that he was actually being obedient to a letter that was written by Jeremiah to the exiles, in that he was seeking the good of the place where he was, in as far as he could do so. But he always put God's law before the law of the land. So if you think of there being three laws of humanity in Babylon, Daniel was obeying a zeroth law, which was the law of God. And he certainly sought the good of others, his three friends, as well as King Nebuchadnezzar and Darius the Mede as well. He cooperated as far as his conscience would allow with the authority of the day. And he occupied a very high position for a very large part of his life as well. And very often people in such positions lose their integrity through 1,000 cuts, an omission here, a half-truth there, a small lie and so on. Sadly, even our current Prime Minister has been subject to that sort of thing, where things have been revealed which maybe were better not done, or maybe it should have been more honest than he actually was. But not so with Daniel. And one of the primary reasons, I think, for that is his faithfulness in prayer. Prayer gave Daniel a new perspective on the world in which he lived. And we need that. There's some terrible things happening in our world, not just in the Middle East, but all around us. And so his enemies here start to try and challenge him. There are parallels with chapter 1 and chapter 3 within the story. In chapter 1, there's that ruling and that vindication as Daniel manages to avoid eating the king's food. In chapter 3, there's that challenge to his three friends. But in chapter 6, this plot is by Daniel's colleagues. His main supporter is Darius, but he's limited. He can't change his mind once this law or decree has been passed. In chapter 3, a fourth person appears in the fiery furnace with Daniel's three friends. And here in chapter 6, an angel appears and protects Daniel. So the story really divides up into four bits here. The first bit is about honesty versus corruption. And it results in a plot against Daniel, who by this time, he's in his 80s. Yes, really, he's in 80s. You're going to see a little reflection song at the end where Daniel appears to be a very young, middle-aged man. That is a misrepresentation. He was definitely in his 80s. And corruption has been there throughout history, hasn't it, really? Both on a large scale and on a small scale. And if you look back at the passage, the stated reason for the appointment of the satraps, or particularly the administrators, was so that the king would not suffer loss. Corruption was the problem. And clearly, human nature hasn't changed much over the years. It was a problem in ancient times as well. And actually, we should remember that at that time, the empire of the Medes and the Persians was the largest empire that ever existed on earth. They didn't have modern technology that we have, so administration would have been indeed a very difficult task. And many of those people, because human nature has not changed really over the years, many of those officials would have been just like some of our current business executives and corporations, both greedy and immoral. But Daniel has so distinguished himself here, surely because of his honesty and straightforward approach, as well as his ability, that Darius is here considering appointing him as the prime minister. And there were many reasons why the others would not be in favour of that. Daniel was older. Daniel was Jewish. And perhaps even more significantly, some of them were probably on the fiddle or just lazy. And his honesty and hard work would have threatened their positions. Daniel would have done his job to the full. If he was there to ensure the king would not suffer loss, that is what he would do. And those who want riches or an easy life are often quite ruthless. And so the plotting begins. And I suspect that these plotters had contacts within the Babylonian equivalent of the CIA or MI5. They had their spies around, and they would have tried to find out what they could. But could they? Not a dot. They couldn't find anything in Daniel's conduct that would be an issue. The only thing that they saw was that he was loyal to God. And so they just thought, how can we use this? And so, secondly, we see that plot, and we see it put into action. But we see that Daniel remains faithful. The zeroth law applies. He just goes on believing. He can't have been ignorant of what was going on, or the hostility that some held towards him. That all in verse 7, where it says all of them together, and they went to King Darius, is clearly a lie. Daniel himself was not consulted. He wouldn't have approved. And I can't really imagine 122 people going in to the king at once. So it would have been an influential group of them who actually went into him and tried to persuade him to put this decree in place. And you can imagine what they would say. Well, this would be a uniting factor, won't it? And this will be good for you, and so on. And they flattered Darius. It would establish his authority. And you would have thought, really, that he might have spoken to Daniel first. But sometimes, particularly if people are playing to someone else's vanity, they don't always think things through. And either his vanity, or possibly God's actual plan to deal with these people once and for all, meant that he didn't do so. And Daniel doesn't scheme or panic. He just believes. He continues with his discipline of prayer, despite the fact that he knows it's going to cause trouble. He feared God rather than men, and he trusted him completely. So we come to the conclusion from verse 12 on. And this is really in two parts. Firstly, God's power versus man's authority. The trap is sprung. Darius can find no legal loophole, although it says that he tried all day to find a way of saving Daniel. So he clearly valued him, I think as an administrator, but I think probably also as a friend. And unlike Nebuchadnezzar, Darius couldn't just change his mind and rescue Daniel. And the lion's den is sealed with a stone to stop any escape. It has a similarity to the way that Jesus' tomb was sealed, perhaps. Darius is distressed overnight. He refuses food and distractions, and that shows the extent of his concern. He couldn't sleep. And then towards dawn, he goes down. The first light of dawn, he rushes down. He looks through the hole at the top of the den that was kept for spectators, would you believe? He's overjoyed at hearing Daniel's voice. God had sent an angel both to stop the lion's natural instinct and to provide company for Daniel. There's no mark on Daniel, just as there was no mark on his three friends when they came out of the fiery furnace. That is God's power, which overrides man's authority in all cases. And then finally, there's retribution, there's a response. And this proves, amongst other things, that these lions were not tame. And it also leads to a public witness to God by Darius as well, and a very interesting one. By our standards, of course, it's a brutal act. It's not actually said that it's commanded by God. It probably isn't approved of by God. It does, however, bring to mind the end of Haman, who was hanged on the gallows he had prepared for Mordecai in Queen Esther's time. Or perhaps in Matthew verse 26, verse 52, where Jesus tells Peter, all who draw the sword will die by the sword. And Darius's decree is interesting because it goes a bit further than the decree that Nebuchadnezzar makes in chapter 3. By actually commanding fear and reverence of Daniel's God rather than forbidding the saying of anything against him. Of course, there's no dreadful consequences if they don't do that. You can't force belief and response on anybody, really. But Daniel has faced a challenge to sin by omission, in other words, to refrain from praying to God, rather than the sin of commission that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego faced with the golden statue. The result, in terms of the king's declaration, is even more remarkable. So that's, sadly, the end of the story of Daniel. The rest of the book of Daniel is rather more complicated to do with visions and the future and so on. But there are a couple of lessons that we can learn from this. Firstly, it's really what Jeremiah said in a letter to the exiles in Babylon. Seek the good of the place where you live, the good of the people we live among. We use our God-given abilities, as Daniel did, and thereby we witness to other people. So when he first arrived in Babylon, Daniel was given the equivalent of a university education in Babylonian laws and customs and culture. I suspect he will have seen little value in that in and of itself. And yet he had to live in Babylonian society, so he cooperated in the process. In fact, so much so that he was excelled and given a very high position in Babylonian society. And he didn't just cooperate, but he was involved as well. Surely he could have avoided these high official positions if he wanted to. He could have played down his own abilities, but that would have been dishonest. At this particular time, he could surely have pleaded old age. But because he knew his own abilities, because he knew the calling that God had given him, he accepted these challenges, challenges that meant a high position over a very long period of time. He was scrupulously honest. He was working well, even at such a great age. And he worked through different periods as well. Remember, the whole empire had changed from being Babylonian to being the Medes and the Persians. And he is working so well that here he is about to be made the second in charge in Babylon. And part of the reason for this esteem was no doubt to his combination of ability and his honesty, an attribute clearly not overvalued by some of the other administrators. He's not just a great civil servant, he's also a friend to Nebuchadnezzar and to Darius. And we're called to be the same in the place where we live, with the people that we live alongside. So it means that we have to be involved. We may not like certain aspects of our society, but we're bound by its laws as long as they don't contradict God's laws. We have a vote on some things. We have the freedom to fight and campaign for change. So in certain circumstances, we should be doing that as well. We shouldn't chafe against the realities of modern living. It's where we are. We need to cope with it. We need to cope with it as well as we possibly can. Although we can always campaign for improvements. And actually, if you look back through history, much of today's social provision and awareness came about because Christians in earlier times became involved. Hospitals, orphanages, many, many other things. We're called to be witnesses to others. We can't be effective witnesses if we are disengaged from the world. Some of our activities may give us a chance to actually tell others about God. Others may just be a witness in themselves because we are actually doing them and we are doing them well. Essentially, that's how Daniel witnessed to rulers such as Nebuchadnezzar, Darius, and later Cyrus for 70 years. So let's take the opportunity to be involved and use the gifts and abilities that God has given us. And then secondly, we need to be faithful to God, whatever the pressure or position, possible cost. And we need to do so both inside and outside of the Christian community. Daniel was faithful to God. In chapter 6, where he was near the end of his life, even in the face of being thrown to the lions, he was faithful. He could have compromised, no doubt, by praying in secret for 30 days. While the foolish decree of Darius was in place. But he saw that as being somehow less than faithful. And in any event, I expect his enemies were just to devise some other challenge to do with his faith in God. It was a remarkable thing for anyone to do, but particularly for a man of his age. But he'd shown his desire to be obedient from the day that he arrived and when he pleaded not to have to take the king's food. That was probably as much because it had been offered to idols as any other reason. And Daniel's three friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, better known as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, their Babylonian names, showed a similar faith when they were faced with the fiery furnace. And Daniel was also faithful in interpreting truly the dreams of kings and the meaning of the writing on the wall, even when those things weren't particularly favourable. So that first dream that he had indicated that Nebuchadnezzar's reign wasn't going to last forever. The second time he had to tell Nebuchadnezzar, actually, you need to change the way that you're behaving or God is going to deal with you. And then in chapter 5, the writing on the wall, where it's too late, Belshazzar, you've been judged. But he gave his interpretations accurately, despite any consequences that might follow. And in the face of threats to his life, Daniel was always obedient to God. He was usually tactful, the one exception perhaps being with Belshazzar, who had gone too far. And we're called to be faithful in the service of God in all aspects of our lives, here and outside as well. The subtle pressures in our society today to privatize Christian belief, to say, you can do what you like, you can practice within reason inside, but you can't tell other people about it. And actually, John Lennox, in his commentary on Daniel, quotes some interesting things that have happened in the United States, where as far back as 1997, there were warnings against students on graduation actually praying, and later still also things where things were severely restricted as what people would say in public, in that they would actually have been arrested and imprisoned had they broken those things. I don't know actually what happened. That isn't actually recorded. But we can't go along with those sorts of restrictions because God's law is the zeroth law. God's law is the one we obey above all others. And so we're challenged sometimes to swim against the flow, as it were. There are plenty of challenges. How do we deal with them? Well, in the same way as Daniel did, really. We use the natural abilities that God has given us. We're in constant contact with God. Daniel had a busy time. I mean, he was a top administrator, and he's still going and praying three times a day. He was under great pressure to get things done, great pressure to perhaps to overlook things by some of his colleagues. His life was in danger, or potential danger, on several occasions. But though he was direct, he was respectful, and where it was appropriate, he was tactful as well. But that life of disciplined prayer could be used by God in the most difficult of circumstances. And so that's what we're called to emulate, so that we can be faithful as he was. And perhaps our own priorities need to be reviewed a little bit if we say we don't have enough time to pray regularly, for example. And some of you, like me, may find it a bit difficult to identify with the Apostle Paul and his roving missionary zeal, his complicated theology, his inability to use commas or full stops. It's perhaps a bit easier to relate to Daniel's life, but it's still an immense challenge, isn't it? But it's more relevant in some ways because most of us here are not, well, as far as I know, all of us here, none of us are in full-time Christian service in the traditional sense, and probably don't feel a call towards that. So we exist in our society doing other things as well. But think again about Daniel's age here. I think he's older than most of us here, possibly all of us. And yet he was still doing these things. So age